This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country and around the world on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, we're going to war with War for the Planet of the Apes, and I'll also be talking about Wish Upon. I'll also have a look at Doctor Who and some other special features later in the show. But first, I'm going to talk about some news and the trailer park. Also going to have some box office predictions and, of course, the home cinema roundup. But before that, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The biggest news that's actually hitting the ground was actually very early in the week, and that is that Daniel Craig is in for one more Bond film, going to be doing Bond 25, reportedly starting to film next year. It is not worth the investment for him to throw so much money at him. I don't know how much he's going to get, but he's probably going to walk away with like $30 to $50 million to do this, which is an absurd amount of money to pay one person to play a character that's been proved. People who are chomping at the bit to play Bond. So if Daniel Craig's going to just phone in his performance like he did in Spectre, I really don't want him as the next Bond. And on top of it, with all this waiting and speculation of is he going to play, is he not going to play, we're getting the years and years in between the movies. I want to go back to the days of the 60s and 70s and 80s when every 2 years you knew you could rely on a James Bond movie coming out and they didn't have to be the biggest movies ever. One of the worst things to actually happen to the Bond franchise is Skyfall being such a hit that then they're trying to recreate that. And I don't want that. I want a good, solid Bond movie that you could just crank out and that it doesn't have to be a billion-dollar movie every single time. Now, with that note, a lot of people have been speculating who could direct it. A lot of people are saying, should it be Christopher Nolan? Christopher Nolan would be a garbage choice for James Bond. And here is why. He came out and had a quote about this, whether or not he would do Bond. And he said, I'd only do it if it, quote, need reinvention. Which is the exact reason not to do a Bond movie. Bond movies work. They have worked for 50 freaking years, and there's no reason to reinvent the character. When they reinvent it, that's them saying, let's set this thing up so we can make billions of dollars every single movie instead of having a cash cow that the studio can just crank out and get good stuff. And this is exactly why Nolan would be a terrible pick for it, because by saying that, he said, I would only do a Bond movie if you needed to change the character significantly, which we don't need to do. It's James Bond, for crying out loud. It's worked since Dr. No in 1962. This concept of only I would only step in if you needed Christopher Nolan to fix it. Well, look how Christopher Nolan fixed the DC universe. Oh, sure, the Dark Knight movies were fine. I would think that if he continued making them and made a Robin spinoff, it would be garbage because Dark Knight Rises lacked the emotional impact, cohesiveness, and logic that the Dark Knight actually had. But on top of that, look at what he did to Superman with him trying to help. You know, and a lot of people blame Zack Snyder, but it's Nolan, too, who made Superman so dark, which gave kind of Man of Steel a soft type of film. And then you got Batman versus Superman. And then finally, when somebody finally deviates away from it, which is what Wonder Woman did, suddenly everyone likes it. So Nolan is not the cure-all for everything. We'll see what happens with Dunkirk. I might like it. We'll see it next week. But right now, this nonsense of only I can fix this, I alone can fix this, is the way Christopher Nolan is approaching it. And that is exactly the reason why you don't want Christopher Nolan doing it. One other piece of news that I think is kind of interesting is Monopoly Hasbro has come out and has not put the Ray character in the Monopoly set. And that's ticking off a lot of people. And I think it's funny watching these people bellyache about this because they're like, oh no, we need the Ray figure. And look, I get it. There are people who want the Ray figure. They're completists. And there are a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, now we've got a more feminist driven Star Wars. And I'm all for it. I love Force Awakens. I think Ray's a great character. Ironically, I think one of the things that makes her work as a character is she's sort of genderless in the movie. If you really watch it, there's no, like, I mean, Finn's sort of attracted to her, and that sort of drives him. And so it does kind of buck the trend of saving the princess sort of thing. But ultimately, what makes her character strong is that she's not overly feminine, oddly enough, and then she's just now feminist icon. Now, what's interesting about this whole Rey figure in the Monopoly set is people have been wanting it and demanding it. Well, Hasbro's come out and said that they have, quote, insufficient interest in basically pulling the existing stuff off the shelves. Essentially, what's happening is the stuff's selling fine without the Rey figurine. There are no people going in there and demanding it. Now, you can go ask customer service and they'll send you one. But in terms of pushing it out on the shelves, it's marketing toys. And you're marketing toys not just to the geeks who are going to buy them, but really when it's toys, an actual toy market, not collectible toy markets, it's about people who want to buy the set. Most people really don't care if Rey's in a Star Wars set or not. Now, there's a lot of people who are doing. They're very vocal on the internet, and it's fine to put her in there. But I mean, she's been in one movie. Give her a couple more movies. You know, maybe then people will have a little more demand. But let's quit shaming toy makers for marketing to their core audience. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Geostorm, directed by Dean Devlin. It opens on October 20th.
One of our thermospheric satellites malfunctioned over Afghanistan.
So your proposal is what?
We shut down all satellites.
I don't need to remind all of you how many people died from catastrophic climate conditions.
Make sure there's no further incidents.
Not a satellite. All of them.
This wasn't a malfunction. It was intentional.
There's potential for catastrophic weather events on a global scale.
A geostorm.
I cannot escape the feel that this is basically Dean Devlin's version of Roland Emmerich's The Day After Tomorrow. There's a lot of absurdity in this movie just watching the trailer. I couldn't cram all the absurdity into the trailer just because you got to get the story. Basically, the story being that we have now weather satellites that, like in Superman 3, instead of reporting the weather, they control the weather, which A, is not possible. You can affect the weather, but you can't control the weather. I was traveling this week and we were driving home across the Midwest and we were stuck in this massive storm that was just following us along. And I said to my son, I said, look how powerful nature is. Look at all the rain and wind that's being dumped on our just personal area, which maybe extends 100 yards in all directions. And that's happening at a scale of hundreds of square miles. You can't control that with just a couple laser beams in the sky. And that's the absurdity of this movie. It doesn't even feel, at least the Roland Emmerich movies felt a little like realistic. This trailer looks just ridiculous, and it looks like Gerard Butler, God bless him. I like Gerard Butler as an actor, but it really looks like he's phoning in this performance in a big way. This looks just silly. And it looks at the level of a Sharknado sci-fi special instead of a major motion picture. But it's due out in October, so we'll see how it ends up. The next one I want to talk about is Darkest Hour, which opens on November 22nd.
We are looking at the collapse of Western Europe within the next few days.
How long have they got if we don't rescue them?
Maybe 2 days. We would need a miracle to get our men out.
You have the full weight of the world on your shoulders.
We're facing certain defeat on land, the annihilation of our army, and imminent invasion. We must negotiate peace talks.
When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
This is Joe Wright's biopic of British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. The most intriguing thing of this is Gary Oldman's performance as Winston Churchill. He is unrecognizable. And I've always loved Gary Oldman because he's a bit of a chameleon as an actor. You almost always can recognize him, but he does play a wide range of characters from very soft and gentle to crazy and insane. He's a fantastic actor and he's a wonderful performer. And it's amazing to see what he's done just in the short trailer. Joe Wright tends to be a lot of flash, but I've never quite had an emotional connection with Joe Wright's work. But this, I think, is going to be a highlight because of the performance, and watch this for an Oscar. This is going to be one of those leading Oscar contenders going into Thanksgiving weekend. So I'm looking forward to this one, actually, for the award potential. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to give my thoughts on Doctor Who and how the season wrapped up, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Wish Upon. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Before I jump into the movie reviews, I want to touch on Doctor Who, which I've been a fan of Doctor Who ever since the 70s, really. I remember as a kid when they would import the old Doctor Who shows onto PBS with Tom Baker as the fourth Doctor. And yeah, the effects were cheesy and you could totally tell it was shot on videotape on a cheap set somewhere in the BBC lot. But I always loved Doctor Who. And when they brought it back in 2005, I started watching it. And I really liked where it was going. So I tend to follow Doctor Who. I figure Doctor Who is sort of, I think Doctor Who ascends a little bit higher than most television. I don't spend a lot of time talking about television because there's so much out there. And there are some great shows out there. I just don't have time to watch it, or sometimes the means. I was asked this week by somebody if I watched Game of Thrones, and I'm like, I don't have HBO, so I can't watch it live, and I'm on Twitter, so I know everything that happens now. So, I mean, I know what happens in the Red Wedding, so why do I bother getting involved in these characters if I know that's coming? So there's a lot of shows that I don't watch, but I make a point to go out of my way and watch Doctor Who, partly for my own history. And they've just wrapped up the latest season of Doctor Who, and this is allegedly Peter Capaldi's last season, which is a shame seeing what happened, because just this season, Capaldi kind of found his stride. And he had a couple seasons there where they kept the old companion, Clara Oswald. And as much as I liked Clara Oswald, Jenna Coleman playing the role, she felt more at home with Matt Smith as Doctor Who. There was never quite the chemistry between Jenna Coleman and Peter Capaldi, and they tried, and they couldn't quite strike a balance between the two of them. So she sort of, her character overstayed her welcome. And finally, when he got Bill, who was his new companion this season, I really liked him. I thought they worked well together, and I thought Capaldi found where he needed to be. He found the sweet spot of the character right in the season where he's going to leave, and that's a shame. One of the things I wish that they could do is they could just drop off companions like they used to do in the past, like where he took Sarah Jane Smith and just dropped her off in Cardiff one day because he was called back to Gallifrey to talk to the Time Lords. I would love to see that, because now there's such a finality to the companion's existence, whether it's Rose being trapped in another universe, or whether it's Rory and Amy being trapped in the past, or whether it's Donna Noble where he can't actually interact with her again, or the universe will explode and stuff like that. Can't we just have him say goodbye and let the past be the past and move on to the next one? That's the big problem I have with making the companions too significant to that storyline. Now, what's interesting, though, about this is it's moving into the Christmas episode. He didn't regenerate at the end of this episode. He's trying to stave off his regeneration, and he runs into the First Doctor. And here's a clip. Now, of course, William Hartnell, who played the original Doctor Who, he's been dead for decades. And it's not the first time they've got a different person playing the role. So this will be interesting to see how they work this in, and whether or not they bring in some of the other Doctors, whether they bring in Matt Smith or David Tennant or even Tom Baker, who doesn't look anything like he did back in the 70s. But this also begs the question of who's going to be the next Doctor Who. And there's a lot of secrecy behind this, and there's a lot of questioning. And one of the big things I've noticed is there's a lot of speculation that you're going to get a female Doctor Who, mainly because they regenerated the Master as Michelle Gomez, as Missy, the character of Missy. And there was a lot of love for that character. Nobody got really upset that the Master went and switched sex. So now they've opened the door for Doctor Who to switch sex. And people have been suggested, like Olivia Colman, who actually works with a previous Doctor Who on Broadchurch, and Tilda Swinton has been tossed around. What I'd like to see, even though, I mean, my personal pick, I'd love to see Richard Ayoade from the IT Crowd take it. I don't think he will. I think he's done with acting. I think he prefers being behind the camera and wants to contribute differently. I don't know if he was ever 100% comfortable being in front of the character with some of the roles he played. He likes directing now, and I think that's going to keep him from being Doctor Who. I do like the idea of finding somebody in the role who's new and different, but the one I'd love to see, I'd actually like to see Michelle Gomez come back and play Doctor Who, because they finalized her story arc in the story of the Master in this last episode. And who knows, wouldn't it be neat for that to be the big spin? Because I thought Michelle Gomez owned that role, and they have already have set up in the past that a Time Lord can regenerate to a specific body that he or she chooses. So that, to me, would be a great twist on the whole thing. So those are my thoughts. It's sad to see Peter Capaldi go. I would have liked to see more of him in his stride, but I've kind of fell in love with him as an actor, and it's great to see him get a big resurgence, and I'm excited to see who's next. I can't wait for the Christmas episode. I'm going to be crossing my fingers and watching with bated breath. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. Well, it's more of a preview, really, because let's talk about Wish Upon. This was not screened. I've been traveling for the last week, so I wasn't able to see it. But let's just go ahead and play the trailer, talk really quickly about this. A girl finds an artifact that grants her wishes, but as often happens in movies, she discovers that there are always strings attached.
I can wish for anything. Money.
Get in. What is happening right now?
Love. Did that just happen?
There have been others who've had the box. They and everyone they loved all died.
When the music ends, the blood price is paid.
It's a demon.
What does it want?
Your soul.
This reminds me a little bit of that horror series Wishmaster that came out in the 90s, which was about a djinn or a genie. And it's the very typical cautionary tale of be careful what you wish for. They literally say that in the trailers. But it is your typical looking PG-13 horror movie. I do like the fact it's not found footage. I will always give points to a movie, even a crappy horror movie, I will give points to for not being found footage. I like the fact also that Joey King is getting work. I think she's a talented young actress. She's been going a bit through some awkward stages, but she still works in the roles, and she's had some unfortunate would-be big movies that flopped, kind of like, I think it was White House Down was the movie that she was in. And she was in that awful Zach Braff Kickstarter movie that he made a couple years ago. But it's nice to see her continuing getting work, and I'm looking forward to her career, because I think she's actually an extremely talented girl. She's sort of stuck in this what looks like it's garbage. It reminds me a bit of the first Ouija movie. Now, the second one was actually really pretty decent. The second Ouija movie worked out really well, and I think that's because it had a good director behind it. This one is still trying to spin off of that feeling of Annabelle and Conjuring and Insidious, where you've got the long, slow, deliberate pacing, and that's cool, but it feels more like The Apparition or some other film that just doesn't quite work. This wasn't screened for critics that I know of, and it's getting creamed in the reviews now that they're sort of eking out from people who paid to go see it themselves. So Wish Upon gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, we're going to be talking about War for the Planet of the Apes.
Because we can, can! Uh-oh.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare.
In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Continuing on with the movie reviews, let's talk about Planet of the Apes. Before we talk about War for the Planet of the Apes, because I'm a big fan of this series, let's talk about the series itself kind of leading up to it. And a couple weeks ago, I reviewed sort of a look back at Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which actually, look, if you haven't had a chance to see that lately, I suggest rewatching Dawn of the Planet of the Apes before you see War for the Planet of the Apes. You can understand what's going on. I think you can go in completely cold and not know any, you've not seen any ape movie and understand this movie. It's not like it's hard to follow, but you're going to get more out of it. It's going to have more nuance. It's going to have the character moments are going to make more sense if you revisit Dawn of the Planet of the Apes before you watch War for the Planet of the Apes. But let's go all the way back to 1968 with the original Planet of the Apes, based on Pierre Boulez's book. Charlton Heston leads a cast of astronauts who crash land on a planet in which apes have become the dominant species.
Discover Planet of the Apes. A civilization where humans run wild in the jungles. And the superior beings are apes.
Now the tribunal has placed you in my custody for final disposition. Experimental surgery on the speech centers, on the brain. And a kind of living death.
By today's standards, what, 50, almost 50 years ago, it's a little bit goofy. At the very first, you got people in ape costumes. It's very clear. They're in ape costumes. Now, they're better than your standard gorilla suit that you saw in the serials and old movies from the 40s. And in fact, I mean, the makeup effects, it won an Academy Award. I mean, it was, these were groundbreaking back in the late 60s and early 70s and developing the masks and that they could kind of articulate their mouths a bit. But there are some things that still don't quite land with this movie. First of all, it's quite different from Pierre Boulez's book because the ape civilization in the book is far more sophisticated than we see here. What I've always found funny about this is, when they made this movie, they said, okay, apes can talk, apes can reason, apes can have science and art and technology and manufacturing abilities, but they still, in essence, live in caves. They live in what looks like a zoo enclosure, but they're very rudimentary. And I find that kind of, it's sort of like when you read a comic like The Far Side and he's got dogs that are able to write and make signs, but the dogs always have kind of like bad English and they write the letters backwards and stuff. It's sort of like it's believable enough in The Far Side that the dogs can write in English, but they can't write perfectly because that would be absurd, which I find kind of funny about sort of the same way with this ape movie. Now there's obviously there was nudity in the original book and for some reason they speak English in the movie and no one ever says, oh, hey, wait, why are you speaking English? I'm on another planet. That's something that you get past. That goes all the way back to Star Trek. Now they retrofitted that with the Universal Translator, but it doesn't quite work with Planet of the Apes. The original's a good movie. It's not my favorite. Actually, my favorite of the entire series was Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which was about the ape uprising. Because if you remember, they have Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and then they set off a nuclear bomb, and they go back in time and escape from Planet of the Apes. And they send the apes back in time, which, of course, is how you get smart apes in the past. And then Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which takes place in, like, 1991 from, like, 1973's perspective, that is kind of what, in some ways, Rise of the Planet of the Apes was based on. And that's actually my favorite of the five from the original series. Well, I liked Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I loved that one. I liked Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. It wasn't my favorite. I liked Rise better. I still think it's funny that in these movies, the horses still get the short end of the stick. I mean, the horses are there going, we're still, it doesn't matter whether it's human or ape. We're being ridden by somebody. The horses are the ones who get shafted in this whole franchise. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now let's talk about War for the Planet of the Apes. After a virus wipes out most of humanity, a lone group of military warriors plan on taking out the apes once and for all.
We are not savages. Apes fight only to survive.
Years from now, your children will ask you, what did you do in the greatest war? And you can tell them, I fought to protect this world.
We created them.
But now, we will bring an end to their kind.
Don't be fooled by this just being a summer science fiction action movie. It's really not an action movie. I mean, it has big action scenes and it has set pieces and it has explosions and guns. So you can say, yeah, it fits the action mold. But at its heart, War for the Planet of the Apes is a drama. It is more than just a drama, even. Because when you take some ideas and you put them in the context of science fiction, it allows you a safe space from which to view our own problems as a people, being our own problems as humanity. And War for the Planet of the Apes is not just about a bunch of monkeys in the woods fighting humans. It deals with heavier issues. It deals with ideas of manifest destiny and slavery and animal rights and human rights and racism. It has shades of the Holocaust and it has shades of the genocide of the Native Americans. It shows there's a huge complexity to culture and society and that you can't control people even from the inside of your own people. It has a way of looking at things where you can relate it to things that are happening in the Middle East and people betraying their own people and people doing the right things, even if it's going to end up bad for them. In some ways, this turns into a bit of the movie The Great Escape. But it also shows the folly of war and sometimes futility of a culture clash. There is a lot of depth to this movie that I think a lot of people will dismiss because they're just going to see a bunch of hairy apes running around the woods. But there's a lot to it. It's dramatic, it's emotional, and it really has a lot to say. Again, like I said, the horses are the ones who kind of get shafted in the whole thing. But it also has some fantastic performances. And just as, like I said, the makeup that they used in the original Planet of the Apes, how that was groundbreaking, when they finally were doing motion capture back, I think it was in 2011 for Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And even now you go back and you look at that movie, you can see some uncanny valley-ness. You can see where the effects break down. They've had 6 years to advance that technology that you watch this movie and it's gotten so good that your eye is completely fooled at times. You don't realize that it's a special effect in many ways. Where you might think it's a guy in an ape costume and they just put the face on. No, the whole thing's generated. And the lighting is very nuanced. For somebody who's a techno geek, somebody who likes the technology of movies, you will be floored by the lighting technology. And there's a scene where they come into this room and this girl, you see her in the trailers. It was when they find, they run into the girl that they have in the trailer, the one that looks like the kid from the poster of Les Miserables. They're using depth of field and the lighting on the different apes as they rack focus between one and the other and realizing that they're not in the original shot. And yeah, you've got Andy Serkis coming back as Caesar, and he is well known for his motion capture performance, but I think a lot of the other people's performances are oftentimes ignored. I thought that Tony Kebbell did such a fantastic job as Koba in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and he has a little bit of a spot in this movie where he gets a little bit of a return. And you've got Steve Zahn playing this wayward ape who joins the pack. There's a lot of humanity in these apes. And you got to look past it as just being a big explosive action movie for the summer. So, War for the Planet of the Apes, I loved. I think it's the best in the series. I think it's probably one of my favorite films of the summer. This is a movie that is probably going to be overlooked for its worth and its impact and what it has to say because it has apes in it. And that's a shame because it's much more than just a summer blockbuster. This movie says a lot about humanity. War for the Planet of the Apes, totally and unequivocally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be looking at an odd look at a comic book that I ran across this week. Also, the weekly box office and the home cinema roundup featuring the 40th anniversary of Smokey and the Bandit. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue, not with the movie reviews, but with a comic review. And I'm actually going to, I don't talk comics all that much. I mean, I talk superhero movies all the time on this show. But I don't talk comic books. I'm a big comic book fan. I have been for years. I used to collect them all the time, but then I didn't have time to read them, but I love comic books. I love that as a graphic art. Well, this week, over the last week and a half, me and my family have been doing some traveling. We drove out from Ohio, rented a car, drove out to Phoenix to visit a friend and to do a little bit of research on a project I'm working on. Then we ended up moseying our way up to Denver again to visit a friend, and I visited one of the stations that airs the Fat Guys at the Movie show, and that is KFKA in Greeley, Colorado, a little bit north of Denver. Got a chance to meet the gang up there, a great group of people, and I sat in on a couple shows because I was in town, and they bought me a pizza. And I mean, I'll do anything for free food, you know, that's the way I am. But we went out and, you know, they had beer and pizza and had a chance to relax and chat with some of the people at the station. And one of the shows I sat in on is called The Nerd Show, and it's on KFKA in Greeley, Colorado. And there's a comic book shop. It's called The Nerd Store in downtown Greeley. I did not get a chance to get there, because I didn't have it in the schedule. But if I'm ever back again, I'm definitely checking it out. And they come in and do The Nerd Show, with the guy who runs the Nerd Store. And he brought with him a comic book. They do a comic of the week spotlight, and no kidding, this is the name of the comic he brought: Shirtless Bear Fighter ! It's from Image Comics. If you go to Image Comics website, which is imagecomics.com, you can find it. But you can also just search on Google Shirtless Bear Fighter, and you should get a hit on it. There's not a whole lot of those out there. Now let me just pitch this idea to you of this comic. This is a guy who's completely ripped. He's like 7 feet tall. He's ripped. He's got a huge beard. He's got a huge manhood. He runs around the woods naked. And in the comic book, apparently there's some that aren't pixelated, but in the comic book that I had a chance to flip through, his, let's just say his area is pixelated out. Whether you're looking at it from front or back, because he's so well endowed, you see it no matter what's happening. And he makes a living fighting bears in the woods. Now, he was raised by bears, and they even flash back to his birth when he was a baby and actually had a full beard as a baby and a giant well-endowedment manhood as a baby, which is, of course, pixelated out as well. He was raised by bears, but for some reason, his job is to fight the evil bears that are in the woods that have glowing red eyes and can talk. And what he does is he works for flapjacks, not pancakes, flapjacks, because he flaps through them like, you know, a stack of 20s, you know, whenever he gets paid. And then he takes the syrup and he puts it in his teeth. He looks like he's on a CSI episode testing to see whether something's really cocaine. And in this comic book, he lives in a cabin made of bear skin. And whenever he punches a bear, it says in giant pain letters, like the old Batman TV show, Bear Punch. This is one of the most absurdly hilarious, over-the-top comics I've read in a long time, where he's working with the Secret Service from Major City. That's the name of the city he's near. And he's out in the forest. And he flies a jet that is covered in bear skin as well. And it makes me wonder, what does this jet do when it gets to the same airport where Wonder Woman's invisible jet is? Are they going to end up finding baby jets afterwards? Because this is one of the most macho characters I've ever seen. It's an absurdly over-the-top story. And you get to the end of it and you say, can it be any crazier? And then there's a tease for the next issue in which he has to battle the hillbilly warlock. It's like a pig-looking creature, but it's an amazing, over-the-top, crazy, fun, ridiculous comic book. I need to get a copy of this, and I'm probably going to subscribe. I think it's a 5-issue series right now. If you're in Greeley, Colorado, go to the Nerd Store. If you're not, search them online and go to their Facebook page, and maybe you can mail order some stuff, but it's worth checking out. If anything, get a copy of Shirtless Bear Fighter! ! And tell them Kevin Carr, Fat Guys at the Movies, sent you. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office, and was I correct? Like everybody else, I said Spider-Man Homecoming was going to win the weekend, and of course I was right, as was everybody else. It did better. The big question was it going to crack $100 million? I said conservatively that it would make $100 million. It made $117 million, which is really good. I mean, that's not top of the heap. And I think that makes sense because there's not the demand for a Spider-Man movie the way there was 15 years ago. The first, when Spider-Man was the only thing out there competing with one other X-Men movie or two. There's so many superhero movies that a Spider-Man movie isn't anything terribly unique, but I think that does show a demand for the character, a demand for the start of the story, and a demand for him to return to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So that was great. That made that much money, and something like 257 worldwide, which is a great number in its own right. So yeah, Spider-Man Homecoming is a bona fide hit. Despicable Me came in second with 33.5, which is a nice little hold, about 150 million coming out of the weekend. Baby Driver still doing quite well. It had 13 million. You know, this week it's already cracked 60 million. It's leading into the weekend with way more than any other movie that Edgar Wright's ever done. And congratulations for him. Continuing the support, you've got Wonder Woman with almost 10 million. It has now gone beyond Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 as the highest grossing superhero movie of the year. Congratulations. And then you've got Transformers The Last Night, which is dropping like a stone and not worth really talking about much anymore. It's still doing okay overseas. It's got 504 million. It's still going to be profitable, but I mean, we'll see if it's as profitable as the last movies. This week, you know, I think it's going to be kind of a horse race between Spider-Man and War for the Planet of the Apes. I think in the end, Planet of the Apes is going to pull it out because it's new. And while Spider-Man is going to still have a four-quadrant appeal, I think it's going to have burned off a bit of its audience from last weekend. And, I mean, even if it does $60 million, it'll come in, I think, inch a little bit under War for the Planet of the Apes. I'm going to say $65 million to be conservative. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up with the home cinema roundup. Today's featured disc is Smokey and the Bandit. There's a new Blu-ray out. It's the 40th anniversary Blu-ray. They've been releasing Smokey and the Bandit as many times as they release Evil Dead. There's about 15 different versions of it. If you want to get the latest one, it's the 40th anniversary. The 40th anniversary was actually 2 months ago for Smokey and the Bandit. But let's just go ahead and play the trailer because it's a fun movie to talk about. A crazy driver agrees on a bet to bring a truck full of bootleg beer from Texas to Georgia in a short 18 hours.
I'll be driving this one. Hey, blocker. You be driving the truck. This is Bandit 1, and that is Bandit 2.
Burt Reynolds, Sally Field, Jerry Reed.
We're going to really have to cook. I mean, put it on the back burner and let's cook. Is that a 10-4?
10-4.
And the only thing that stands between them and an $80,000 prize, Jackie Gleason as Sheriff Buford T. Justice.
Bandit, I've got a Smokey report for you.
Smokey and the Bandit was one of those movies that it existed in the year that Star Wars was out there, and it managed to have its own niche outside of the Star Wars movies, which is great because it showed that Star Wars didn't just completely dominate 1977. There's nothing really, I mean, necessarily redeeming about Smokey and the Bandit. It's a screwball comedy. It's a slapstick movie. And it's about people driving and crashing into cars. And this was a real craze back in the 70s. You had movies like Smoking the Bandit, and later you had Cannonball Run, and of course you had Convoy. You have a lot of these road trucker kind of movies that really kind of relied on the CB craze. And those were a lot of fun. Ultimately, Smoking the Bandit is a silly movie. It's Burt Reynolds at its best. Just being sort of that cocky yet lovable guy. Jerry Reed's kind of underrated in the movie. He sings the title song, but he also plays one of the truck drivers. Of course, Jackie Gleason as the sheriff. He's over the top and crazy, and that's what makes it so fun because he's so dastardly, but he's also very fun to watch. And then Sally Fields is really quite fetching in this movie. She looks great. She probably, again, at her prime. And she's adorable, yet she's spunky, and she kind of gives Bandit a run for his money. This is just a fun lark of a movie. If you haven't seen it, check it out. I showed it to my kids a couple years ago, and even in today's frame, you know, a kid who's 10, 11, 12 years old can find a lot that's silly and fun about a movie like this. So I'm going to have to say Smoking the Bandit totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
The other movies this week that are hitting Blu-ray and DVD include The Fate of the Furious, Smurfs The Lost Village, Their Finest, The Lost City of Z, Spark A Space Tale, and the Doctor Who spinoff Class Season 1. That is it for this week. Next week I'm going to be talking about Dunkirk, Girls Trip, and Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.